They signed their death warrants for unalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And the fact that we, through our docility and complacency, would squander that in favor of a dictator, whether it's Trump or a successor, to me, it's just a catastrophe. It's the highest form of ingratitude. There, if they were awake today, they'd say, what did we die for? What did we sacrifice for? Yet nothing. You've turned this into ashes.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. Before we begin, I want to again thank you for making this show what it is. Please continue to like, to subscribe, to refer your friends and family members to it. It really means a lot to us. And that's the only way we're able to get things done. I am very pleased to be joined today by one of my dearest friends. Bruce Fine is one of the country's leading constitutional scholars. He is a regular face on Capitol Hill. It seems he drafts half the bills that we see being sponsored for passage on Capitol Hill. And he's also former acting Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Bruce, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, John, for that very, very glowing introduction.
And a big baseball fan.
Yeah, a big baseball fan too. Yeah, my father was a relief pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers when Casey Stengel was playing center field. So that's how far back it goes. But I always have to remind audiences after introductions that none of the words are said under oath, so you get to exaggerate just to make it all pleasing for the audience. Yeah,
Bruce, I've been in Washington a long time, 44 years. You've been in Washington longer than that. And I'm hard-pressed to see the kind of mean-spiritedness and political infighting and just I've never seen Washington like this before. I mean, I was a little bit too young to pay close enough attention during Watergate and the immediate aftermath of Watergate. The summer of 68, I was just a child. But in my adult and semi-adult lifetime, I've never seen Washington so broken.
Yeah.
What do you see?
Yeah, I think that's true. John, I am a little older. My baptism in Washington really was largely around Watergate. I came to the Department of Justice at that time. I worked then for President Nixon's impeachment. The Department of Justice had a Chinese wall between the White House at that time. Robert Bork was then acting Attorney General because the Attorney General and Deputy Mr. Richardson and Ruckelshaus had resigned. The Watergate hearings proved a very unifying force because it disclosed the Americans still rallied behind the idea that the Constitution is what you could call the gospel of the United States, our secular religion. And there's certain things. And remember, John, this was a president who had won 49 of 50 states in 1972. He had captured over 60% of the popular vote, 520 electoral votes. So a landslide victory, and we're coming on the heels, a victory vastly superior to anything witnessed by Mr. Trump. And yet with the hearings, one by one, even some of those who had at some time been a loyalist like John Dean, you remember he had a very famous cancer on the presidency speech. He said, I can't do this anymore. We can't pay off these burglars to cover up the Watergate crime. And they did come forward. We had Dean's testimony and Alex Butterfield about the White House tapes. So despite the fact that you had an enormously popular president and we were in the same alleged crisis, you remember the Yom Kippur War was going on. And it wasn't as though the world was Pacific. Still, the nation did ultimately, through the hearings, the deliberative process, both Republicans and Democrats said, Mr. Nixon needs to go. And when he finally resigned on August 9th, 1974, it was Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott, Republicans, who went to the White House and said, you got to leave here. We cannot have a system where the president can cover up, obstruct justice, abuse. Remember, he had his enemies list, so he's sending the IRS and the FBI after his enemies. And then he had disobeyed, a House subpoena for the White House tapes. And that was sufficient to force him from office. It was what I would call a de facto impeachment. And remember as well for our audience that impeachable offenses is called in Article 2, Section 4, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that was understood to mean political offenses, not necessarily a criminal offense where there's something like a murder or a rape or even a particular victim. But the country as a whole was the victim because it was an attack on the processes of separation of powers and constitutional government and the rule of law. It's not a standard that is as high and as strict as criminal prohibition for a very simple reason. The punishment isn't going to prison. It's not even a fine. It just means to take from the apprentice, you're fired. You got to leave. We don't trust you anymore with the stewardship of our liberties and rule of law. And at the end of the impeachment process, where President Nixon resigned rather than face impeachment charges, the country was relatively unified that he had to go. I think his popularity rating was now in like maybe 18, is approaching single digits. And what actually divided the country was President Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon, which I think was wrong. I think at least they should have gone through a trial where all the information was disclosed, an educational process. You could pardon afterwards if there was a stiff sentence. Mm-hmm. But I believe the pardon is what lost Gerald Ford the election. Now, if we race forward to today, I mean, there has never been anything like Mr. Trump's scorn for any idea of law that would distinguish the country from a dictatorship. And I use the word dictatorship, you know, carefully. And these are Mr. Trump's own words to the New York Times. The only thing that restrains my power, not the Constitution, not law, my moral conscience. That's it. He boasted. This was not a Freudian slip. This is something that he's repeated over and over again. He told NBC News, no, I really don't have to honor my oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution. These are his own words, July 23rd, 2019. Quote, then I have Article 2 where I have the right to do anything I want as president. Now, these are not just words. Let's think of the actions he's taken under the aegis that he can do anything he wants. We have committed murder at almost 200 times in the Caribbean and the East Pacific by using the military to exterminate alleged drug traffickers. If they're doing anything, it's a criminal violation. They're not engaged in invasion with impunity. And it continues as we speak today. This is murder. We've kidnapped and killed Cubans in the process, the president of a foreign country, Mr. Maduro from Venezuela. He has decided that he has identified Venezuela as an enemy country that is, in fact, John, invading the United States. That's his words. Does anyone really believe on this program there's an invasion by Venezuela? They can't even manufacture a vacuum cleaner, you know, an invasion. He's also said that he's decided that Venezuelan gangs are also enemies of the United States, and they are engaged in military warfare against the United States in order to justify kicking out and sending to dungeons in El Salvador persons he claims are unauthorized aliens who don't have any dispensation to remain. Those are just some. Then we see with this infinite power what he's done now, bombing Iran, continues to bomb Iran. It looks like one of our Tomahawk missiles killed nearly 200 elementary school children, girls in Iran. He's hitting civilian targets. We can't trust Mr. Trump or Mr. Hegseth, the defense secretary, to tell us the truth. These are all war crimes. Indeed, the war, just I want to pause here for a second just to underscore the gravity. And let me pause to reflect on the Nuremberg Tribunal. That was post-World War II tribunal that we sponsored to try the high-level Nazi officials for various war crimes. Now, in that tribunal, a war crime was defined as the operation of, quote, aggressive war, crimes against peace. This is Article 6A of the International Military Tribunal Charter. Again, this is the United States sponsored that. We sentence to death, John, death, the likes of Hermann Göring, von Ribbentrop, Jodl, and others, 8 high-level Nazis, for participating in aggressive war against Poland, Denmark, Norway, Netherlands, Belgium, France, Soviet Union, okay? Now, I'm boasting here. I have read all 19,600 pages of the Nuremberg Tribunal transcript, okay? It's really chilling and shocking. Now, the defense, listen to the defense, John, of the high-level Nazis was, listen, if we didn't go along with what Adolf Hitler said, he's going to kill us. This is act. If there was ever a large, I mean, at least a persuasive case of acting under duress, this is it. The Gestapo shows up, you disappear. It wasn't at Auschwitz, but you still disappear. So the argument that that these high-level Nazis who we sentenced to death were acting under duress is very, very powerful. The tribunal said, sorry, that's not a defense. Okay, but that's what they're up. Here, the Hague says, the Tulsi Gabbards, the Marco Rubios, they're not acting under any like dress like that. And yet they are participating with Mr. Trump in a crime of aggression. No one plausibly believes that Iran was about ready to attack the United States when we attacked them. You know, didn't have any capacity. They were in running almost a local, trying to suppress a local insurrection already. They were not running around contemplating an invasion of the United States. So under any definition of aggressive war, this is aggressive war, as it's ongoing now. The same with regard to Israel. Now, let me just pause another time to focus on this idea of nuclear weapons. Neither the United States, Israel is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It probably has, you would know the estimates of the CIA, maybe 200-300 nuclear warheads. It's in that range. It permits zero outside inspection of its nuclear facility. Nobody can go near that, right? The United States is a signatory to the convention, the treaty, but we are able, because we are one of the initial authors of the treaty, we're grandfathered in, our nuclear arsenal is not controlled by the treaty. But, and we do not permit a single outsider to monitor our nuclear weapons. Warheads probably close to 5,000. Iran is a signatory, and as imperfect as it is, it provides some outside inspection. So who's the greatest threat? Israel? U.S., which is the only country that's ever used nuclear weapons? Or Iran? And Iran clearly has a rational justification for having at least some nuclear deterrent, because they saw what happened to Libya when Muammar Gaddafi abandoned WMD, and we invaded his country, bombed it to smithereens, turned it into wilderness, and Gaddafi was killed. So what country is going to invite suicide? So you put all that together, John, I'm saying, we have a president and his subordinates who are currently engaging in the crime of aggression that we punished after World War II with the death penalty. That is an impeachable offense under any standard whatsoever. And I want to underscore as well that it's not just Iran. Mr. Trump has said, I can do this to any country in the world, anytime I want, based upon my whim alone. Could be Canada the next day, could be Norway because he didn't give him a Nobel Peace Prize, because he has all of the maturity of a 2-year-old, I guess. Very angered after he didn't receive the peace prize. He said, okay, I'm not going to be in favor of peace anymore. So, and impeachment is intended to stop a calamity before it occurs. If there's a clear and present danger, it's because you're just firing a chief executive. Nothing else happens to the individual on that score, which is why, by any rational standard, Mr. Trump is engaging in impeachable offenses that Congress needs to remedy very, very fast. Now, I have worked with Congressman John Larson's office of Connecticut. There's a resolution, a House Resolution 1155, identifying articles of impeachment with explanation, and we hope we can get a House vote on it as early as next week. The leadership can't block votes on impeachment. But that's where we are. John, I don't want to sound like Cassandra, but if we don't push back on this assertion of power, this country is doomed. We are not going to survive. Remember as well, no president has ever surrendered power back, inherited from a predecessor. So it's not just Trump. A successor to Trump is going to be the same arbitrary despot dictator as he is. And he'll just say, but I'll be a benevolent dictator, will be his argument.
I have so many questions, but let's talk about that first. Why have we seen the Congress just almost proactively cede its authority as a co-equal branch of government to the executive? We've never seen anything like this. But you know, to listen to Lindsey Graham say it, he would be perfectly happy with the Donald Trump dictatorship and doesn't want Congress to do anything that might stand in the way of any of Donald Trump's programs. Why has that become the norm on Capitol Hill?
Yeah. Well, it's complicated, but I think that there is an answer to it. It's not a very pleasant one. And that is, at the outset, John, the key figures in our dispensation were largely members of Congress. Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, Thomas Hart Benton, John Quincy Adams, Abraham Lincoln. Presidents other than George Washington were more on the sidelines until the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln. Now, why did things change? Why we can't even remember members of Congress? They're all, tails, to dogs. You know, they're poodles out there. And it didn't happen overnight. It happened slowly. But the reason I believe is this: if a country decides philosophically it wants to be an empire, you can't run an empire without a Caesar. Whether you call it a de facto Caesar or a legal Caesar, because you need unity, dispatch. You can't wait around and deliberate because you got to try to conquer the whole world. You remember Madeleine Albright, we see farther than anybody else, and we have to tell everyone how to live their lives. And so at the outset, John, in 1789, when the Constitution was finally ratified and we began, we were small. We didn't even have the ability to be an empire, even if we wanted to. We simply didn't have the economic and military sinews to do that. I also believe we didn't want to be an empire. We didn't get rid of, remember, who was our opponent in the Revolutionary War? It's the British, the huge empire. It was kind of like the British were the U.S. like we are to Iran. We won the Revolutionary War anyway. But the British were the ones that we hated and despised. We said, no, we're not going there. We don't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. We fight and defend our own independence and freedom. We wish it well everywhere by example, but not by bayonets, okay? So at the one end, and I show that this was genuine because at the formative years, I call the teenage years of the United States, all of Latin and Central America were up in rebellion against the Portuguese and Spanish empires. We could have intervened if we wanted to because Portugal and Spain then were very decrepit. We didn't. We said, you know what? That's your business, not ours. We are not going to interfere. Like I say, we just take care of ourselves and influence you by example. But by the time of the, what I call the turn of the century, 1890s, 1900, we then, because of our great system, and we attracted immigrants and entrepreneurs, that we had the economic and military might that had surpassed Great Britain and Germany at the time. And that is when we decided philosophically, even if we didn't debate it, let's be an empire. So we annexed Hawaii. We did we fought against the Philippines in the Spanish-American War. We kind of made it up because the USS Maine, it being exploded, it really wasn't the Spanish. It was the people who didn't keep the coal right, so it exploded.
It was
itself.
A boiler explosion.
Yeah, it was a boiler explosion, right. And you can imagine the stupidity. Why would Spain is a little decrepit country. Why would they attack the USS Maine, and invite retaliation? But anyway, at that time, it wasn't really a war against Spain for Cuba. We attacked the Philippines. And when they said, we want self-determination, we said, no, sorry, we got to control you. We are the new chosen people of God. We succeed in the steps of Joshua and the Old Testament. And so we got to go global in terms of our projection. And it's at that time, John, this is 1900, where the president starts to say, we have all power to do whatever we want unless the Constitution says no. That's kind of Teddy Roosevelt. And it's at that time you'll see the president then becomes overwhelmingly dominant. And so we're into Panama, we're into Nicaragua, we're into Haiti, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Honduras, all these places. Initially, it was just Latin America. Then it went global, really in spades after World War II. But it was because we had cast aside the idea that our greatness as a country was liberty and the rule of law, the march of the mind, and say, greatness is measured by how many other countries do we control, right? And that's the philosophical. And when you have that different philosophy of why you exist, even the words of the Constitution, they started to become homonyms. They sounded the same, but they were interpreted to give president no limitless power. And so once we decided, hey, empire is our goal, not liberty anymore, you got to have a Caesar. So this is all these newfangled claims of executive privilege, and you can go to war on your own. The last real, I think, stop and block on limitless executive power was Henry Cabot Lodge and defeating the Paris Peace Treaty, the League of Nations, which would have, if it was ratified, led the president go to war anytime he wanted to. And Henry Cabot Lodge says, you know, we're not giving up the war power, because they know in times of war, the president has limitless power, Congress reduced to an inkblot. So they said, no, only we can decide, as the Constitution says, that we can go to war by a declaration. So if you keep that incrementally, starting from 1900, we keep getting a bigger, bigger empire every single year. Because it really has no stopping point. Power is insatiable. You know, that's why Napoleon goes to Moscow and loses 2 million French soldiers, and he comes back even after Elba. Why Hitler goes into Barbarossa? What the hell is he attacking the Soviet Union? It destroyed himself, right? Since power is insatiable. And that's why us, after we became invincible, where we had no existential threats, then we jumped NATO membership, you know, from 10 or 12 to 31 now for what? I mean, it's utterly insane. We, you know, we bring in so we can defend North Macedonia and Montenegro. What the heck is this about? You know, and we get nervous if the Solomon Islands lets China build a road. You know, these are complete absurdities, but it's because the empires have no stopping point. They have to always find something new to conquer, because they have no philosophical foundation. So, and that's why I believe, you know, we've become more polarized. And since so much power now sits in the White House, you know, the divisions become greater because the stakes are high. You know, if you're fighting over a cafeteria ticket, you know, to get a hamburger, okay, you may have dispute, but okay, it's not so much that you're really going to be angry if you don't get it. But the White House now has so much money, $7 trillion, all the nuclear arsenals and power in the world. Everyone's fighting, and they'll lift heaven and earth to try to get there. That's what we saw at least earlier on January 6th of 2021, when Trump basically tried to overthrow the government of the United States by force and violence, including hanging Mike Pence. And that's where we are at present. That's why we have to shift and change. We have to have our unity behind the Constitution. We can disagree with regard to policies and personalities, but the rules, we have to agree on the rules of the game. You know, this is how you get elected. This is how you challenge things. This is how you pass laws. Without that, it's just the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. That's a fancy way of saying the law of the jungle. And that means we've lost 250 years of time since July 4, 1776. And I want to understand, why is that, at least to me, so tragic? There are 56 signatories, John, to the Declaration of Independence. They signed their death warrants. They lose that war, they're dead. And they're fighting against the greatest empire in the history of the world at that time. They signed their death warrants for unalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And the fact that we, through our docility and complacency, would squander that in favor of a dictator, whether it's Trump or a successor, to me, it's just a catastrophe. It's the highest form of ingratitude. If they were awake today, they'd say, what did we die for? What did we sacrifice for? Nothing. You've turned this into ashes. We now have kings again.
I want to ask you in a moment about declarations of war and the use of the War Powers Act. But first, I want to read a word from one of our sponsors. What if one signature from President Trump could create more American millionaires than any event in modern history? It's not fantasy. It's happened before. In 1934, FDR signed an executive order that revalued gold literally overnight. It transferred billions in wealth from a single stroke of a pen. Trump has the same legal authority, and he's been hinting at using it. Here's why it matters to you. There's a massive gap between what the government says its gold is worth and what gold actually trades for today. We're talking a difference of over $1 trillion. That gap has to close eventually. When it does, gold prices could explode, but only people positioned beforehand will benefit. Central banks already see this coming. They've been buying gold at record levels for 3 years straight. I've partnered with American Alternative Assets to release a free report called The Great Gold Reset. It explains exactly what's happening and how to position your retirement before the window closes. So go to johnlovesgold.com to get your free copy. That's johnlovesgold.com or call 1-888-GOLD-053 and they'll mail one to you. Bruce, you and I have had this conversation 1,000 times. The U.S. government, the U.S. Congress, has not declared war on a country since December 8th, 1941. We've played with the idea of the War Powers Act every time there's a conflict, and sometimes it's invoked and sometimes it's not invoked. Why have we not declared war since 1941? And is the War Powers Act really worth the trouble of debating it?
And there's wonderful questions, John. But let me just comment upon your promotion. The fact is that Congress could shut down Trump's authority in 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. The only reason why he has that power is because Congress has given it away.
That's right.
When Roosevelt acted in the 1930s, he did it by executive order. There wasn't any statute. And in fact, the Supreme Court in a case called Perry versus U.S. said, yeah, it was illegal, but there isn't any remedy for it. So anyway, what you've described is a symptom of the disease we're talking about right now. But let me go back, and you know, sometimes a few pages of history is worth volumes of logic, as they say. So if we look at the Constitution and its evolution in Philadelphia in 1787, the framers were unanimous, saying, we're going to entrust the power to take the country from peace to war to Congress alone. They specifically said, the president cannot take us to war. He can respond when war has already begun because we've been attacked. That's in self-defense to a sudden attack. But otherwise, only Congress can take us from a state of peace to war. And they explain why is that. 100% of history teaches that wars are always started by executive because you get the generals, you get limitless power in wartime, national security, the jingoism, the monuments, footnotes in history and whatever. Said, we will never trust anyone to go to war on their own, even somebody as trustworthy as George Washington. And again, this was understood by 100% of the participants in the Constitution and the ratification, including those who were in favor of a very muscular presidency like Alexander Hamilton. No, you have to give the war power to Congress. And that was faithful, you know, up until the usurpations began. I would say the first usurpation really was James K. Polk. Because although Congress declared war against Mexico in 1846, James K. Polk, the president, lied to Congress. They said that an American soldier had been killed on American soil. But it was a big lie. Abraham Lincoln, who was then a member of Congress, introduced what's called the spot resolution, said, you show us the spot in the United States where the killing occurred. A Polk ran away. You know, he wouldn't respond. And in fact, Congress passed a law saying that the war was unconstitutional. So it really wasn't a bona fide declaration because it was based on fraudulent representation of the president. But if we go back, there have only been 5 declared conflicts in 230 some years. So the founders were quite accurate in understanding that Congress was not going to war unless it really is serious self-defense. That's why it's only declared war on five occasions. And when they thought we've already been attacked, sometimes we obviously were before or after Pearl Harbor. So why has Congress just stopped getting involved? But part of the phenomenon, John, of Congress giving up its powers everywhere, including the war power. Shortly after, if you think about it, after World War II, we had the Korean War. Harry Truman called the Korean War a police action. He said, I don't need Congress. A police action involving 3 million Chinese soldiers, millions of casualties, a risk of nuclear war that MacArthur wanted to carry in the Yalu River. That's a peace action. In fact, as we speak at this very moment, John, we don't have a peace treaty in Korea. We have a truce since 1953. And Harry Truman said that's not war. That's what he said. And so you can, if that's the benchmark, obviously President gone to war since then. I mean, most have started out the Vietnam War, but I would consider really, John, the Bay of Pigs to be a war against Cuba. We sponsored it. The attempt was to overthrow Cuba, to invade its sovereignty. Congress never authorized the Bay of Pigs disaster or calamity whatsoever. And then after we failed in Cuba, then we go into Vietnam. We start the CIA ran a secret war against Laos for 10 years, starting in 63. Then we go into the Dominican Republic in 65. And it's, you know, so we had all these presidential wars and Congress really has done nothing. There were only two votes against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that gave the President Johnson, you can do whatever you want in Vietnam.
Right.
Ernest Goering and Wayne Morris was unanimous.
And they lost their seats after that.
Yeah, right. And they lost their seats despite the fact by 1970, Congress repealed the resolution saying this was crazy. They still lost their seats, okay? So we don't have Congress wanting to vote now. A part of it is because this idea, because we grow up in a culture of being an empire, okay, you got to give limitless power to the president. He's commander in chief, and you know how can we conquer all the world? And I think part of the success, John, has been the CIA, because the CIA has undertaken what I call vast threat inflation. You know, they started with the Soviet Union. Remember the bomber gap and the missile gap, all the huge lies. They're saying the Soviet economy was robust when it was flat on its back. And so the CIA, the intelligence agencies are used to try to frighten the American people. Think our adversaries, you know, walk on water, which is utterly ridiculous and absurd. And so they enable, you know, the Congress say, well, we can't get involved. And the CIA, of course, is notorious. They have all the secret. They keep everything classified. So nobody knows whether they're telling the truth or not. And we know most of the time they take lies. Look at the Pentagon Papers when it was finally released with the help of Daniel Ellsberg, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Lie after lie after lie about Vietnam. So that's why I think we ended up with all these presidential wars, because Congress no longer feels that it wants to play a role. It says, okay, you decide. Then the cynical attitude, John, is if the war goes south, we blame the president. So we don't have to be accountable for this, although they continue to fund the war. Now, finally, there's one kind of exception. In 1973, Congress did cut off all funding for combat operations over Vietnam after August 15th, 1973. Now, that was after the January peace accords in Paris, but it prevented President Ford from trying to reinitiate the Vietnam War, you know, when North invaded and conquered the South in 1975. Congress said, there's no way, we're not giving you any money. War's ended. Now, also, I say this was an act of diplomatic genius of Congress. Where are we now? Vietnam now is an ally of the United States against China, you know. So they wouldn't be an ally, I can guarantee you, if we bombed them back into the Stone Age, as Curtis LeMay wanted us to do. Again, the same tactic that we have in Iran. Think of that. We had bombed them back in the Stone Age was our formula for winning the Vietnam War. And now we're going to try it again in Iran. I mean, the level of stupidity, I guess, boggles the imagination.
Yeah, and we could talk all day about this, too. You know, we're committing obvious war crimes. For example, bombing civilian infrastructure, electrical grids, bridges that have no military import.
Universities, too.
Universities. Mm-hmm. Hospitals. Yeah. These are all separate impeachable offenses, and they're literally war crimes. They're in the international statutes.
Yeah, and we utilize these criminal prohibitions to send Nazi leadership to death. We use them. It wasn't just an academic element here. So Congress then has surrendered its war power, unfortunately. Both Democrats and Republicans, again, beginning at least with Harry Truman. And that's why I'm working almost nonstop to try to get this reversed, to try to get some pride and say, you know, you're taking the country off of a cliff, and it's your responsibility to obey your oath of office and to enforce the Declare War Clause. If you ask right now, John, would Congress vote to declare war against Iran?
No way.
There is not a chance. Presidents don't ask Congress to declare war because they're making up the danger, and Congress would never go along. See, because there is no incentive for Congress. Say their members, they sing the same national anthem, the same Pledge of Allegiance, the same loyalty. They have no interest in selling the United States short. So if the only reason why Congress would not declare war is because the president is making up the danger, it doesn't exist. Otherwise, they'd vote for it right away. I remember as recently as 2013, President Barack Obama, he asked Congress for a declaration of war against Syria, allegedly used chemical weapon. He couldn't get a single vote, not one vote. And the American people were writing into members and saying, this is nuts. Syria, and we don't applaud Assad, but what the heck? If we have to pick out every bad man to overthrow and bomb and invade, we'll be at war 24 hours a day, for the next 50 or 60 years, Kim Jong-un, the military dictatorships in Burma, in Congo, and Africa, we'd be fighting the whole world. And we'd lose our ability to be a democracy because in times of war, law doesn't have any meaning. So that we understand that the reason why presidents go to war without asking Congress, because they can't get the votes out of Congress, which affirms that these are ridiculous, stupid wars that are fought only to give a president an adrenaline high.
I want to ask you about present day politics in 1 second. I want to give our listeners a word from our other sponsor. If there is one thing that we've learned over the last few years, it is that access to medication can change quickly depending on politics, regulation, and corporate influence. That's why it's important to have a pharmacy that focuses on access and transparency, not on bureaucracy. This is the reason why people are turning to All Family Pharmacy. Instead of scheduling doctor visits, sitting in waiting rooms, and dealing with insurance approvals, the entire process is handled online. You choose the medications you need on their website, you fill out a short medical form, and a licensed doctor reviews your request. If appropriate, they provide the prescription. Then your order ships directly to your door. It's a simple way to keep essential medications on hand like antibiotics, antivirals, ivermectin, mebendazole, NAD+, and more than 400 other prescription medications that people rely on every day. Prepare now before you need it in the future. Visit allfamilypharmacy.com/John and use promo code JOHN10 to save 10% on your next order. Bruce, I want to get back to the current articles of impeachment that you have drafted. First of all, do you think that there's any chance that a Republican-led House of Representatives, even one with a razor-thin majority, would be unable to convince the Republican caucus to vote unanimously or near unanimously against? And sort of as a companion question, is this really a dress rehearsal for November? Well, for January, when Democrats are likely to retake the House and then almost immediately take up articles of impeachment.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So I want to underscore for our audience that when the Watergate hearings began against Nixon, everyone said, it's never going to happen. is not going to happen. He had won such a landslide in 72. And it did happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen overnight. It took like 12 months. So politics can change very fast. I do believe that in May, perhaps the most decisive event that will dictate whether impeachment could happen this year is going to be in Kentucky, where Thomas Massie has a primary. Thomas, a very loud critic, and I have to say I'm a friend of President Trump. Trump has made it a personal grudge to try to crush Mr. Massie. Entered his district. He's got tens of millions of dollars from AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, against Thomas, say perhaps the most expensive congressional race in the history of the United States. And if Massie, a staunch Republican, as clear a Republican as you can get, can prevail despite Trump, don't worry, there are a large number standing in the queue to join him. It'll show that Trump is no longer the lion killer. If that happens, then impeachment this year certainly becomes credible, in part because Mr. Trump becomes more and more deranged every day. Somebody who would stoop to the vulgarities, the language that he uses, disesteeming everybody, dehumanizing everyone, obliterating civilizations. And he's probably going to get the same or worse as the days unfold. Clearly, unless you're in some kind of state of hypnotic somnolence, you can understand this is not a stable person. It's not, no matter what metric you use. And I think it's important to underscore is this is not, I don't have any personal animosity toward Mr. Trump. My loyalty is the United States Constitution. And if Trump goes, you have J.D. Vance would succeed him. J.D. Vance, I think, would learn he doesn't want to get impeached. And I think that he would at least follow the Constitution. I may disagree, but that would be the legitimate way in which the process would occur. And so it's not a coup d'etat, like you're replacing Donald Trump with Hakeem Jeffries or Nancy Pelosi. No, the power of the presidency would still remain in Republican hands. Fine. Even if I don't really agree with Republicans or Democrats, but that's the way the process works. And process is everything. It's the foundation of civilization. So I do think it's possible that, and this happened in Watergate too, if Republicans see that they're going to get a shellacking in November, unless they walk away from this man who's now pushing oil or gasoline prices towards $5 a barrel and nobody knows when it's going to end, that I do think you could get impeachment and Republicans turn against President Trump, just like Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott turned against President Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, how do you see the Senate responding to something like this? I think that you're right. I think that the House is going to impeach Donald Trump again. It may not be this year. It may be at the start of next year, but I think it's going to happen. What does that mean in an evenly divided or almost evenly divided Senate?
Well, I think that the Senate will respond to prevailing public opinion, even though there are only a third of them up in November rather than the entire chamber, unlike the House. Don't worry, if they see the ratings and the American people saying we got to get rid of this guy, they're going to vote to convict. You're going to get the two-thirds vote, especially if they see then the House side, the number of Republicans who have jumped, against Trump. Now, there's a certain core that will never jump no matter what. But if you get half of the Republican caucus, and part of the reason why it's more plausible than in typical times because Mike Johnson is such a weak, anemic House
historically
speaker.
Weak.
Yeah. And he boasts that he's just sits as a poodle to the White House. So I don't think he is really able to exert any influence on any of the other Republican members, but public opinion will. And I think that every day, in my judgment, Trump becomes more and more unhinged with his language of the recklessness. I mean, does he not know, China and Russia have nuclear weapons? Pakistan has nuclear weapons. If Iran thinks that they're needed to deter the United States and Israel, they're going to use them. People think, well, Iran will never have a weapon because they don't have the weapons to create uranium. China, Russia, they're looking at, hey, this is a way to make Iran another Vietnam for the United States. So they're giving everything they can to support Iran.
Dewey Claridge, a former very, very senior CIA operations officer who died several years back, in one of his final interviews on I think it was BBC, said that the Saudis have nuclear weapons. Yeah. You just buy them. If you're not enriching your own uranium, you buy them from the Pakistanis or from the North Koreans.
Well, that's AQ Khan, right? He kind of had a national business. It was profit center was harming other countries with nukes enough money. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So, I mean, this is dangerous stuff. And we know, the level of antagonism and fanaticism. I mean, yeah, you have fanaticism surely within Iran, but Netanyahu and these others, Ben Gavir, mm-hmm. the Israeli side, they're equally fanatic.
Yeah.
Real radicals. I would not put it beyond them to engage in nuclear exchanges.
One last question for you, and it's about that issue, actually. A friend of mine is a prominent full professor of history at American University, the founder of the Nuclear Studies Program, and he believes that the Israelis will use nuclear weapons with the support of the United States. His position is that he believes Donald Trump wants to break the final taboo of warfare because he believes that it might free up future presidents to use nuclear weapons when needed, even in the face of public opposition. That sounds crazy to me, but he's standing behind it. What do you think? What's your analysis?
No, if there's, I think, a weak chink in the analysis is to believe that Trump is anything but a narcissist. Donald Trump could care less about what happens in the future of the presidency of the United States or anything else. He is fixated on one thing only his entire life, me, right? So if he uses nukes, it's not because he cares about freeing up other presidents whatsoever. And I think he probably may be a little bit deterred because then what's going to happen to his ballroom, his golden arches or whatever. I think your friend imputes much more rationality in thinking than Trump has ever displayed in his entire life. Again, I've never seen anyone so completely preoccupied with himself. He's so true, that he puts his name on everything. The Kennedy Center. He says, "I'm going to control the Library of Congress." Pretty soon, everything that moves. I know. Recently, I fly regularly to West Palm Beach International Airport. Now it's going to be the Trump Airport. So that's what this guy cares about. This is the other stuff, man. That's way beyond his pay level for sure.
Well, Bruce Fine, last question: where can people read more about your work?
Well, if you come to my website at www.lawofficesofbrucefine.com, I have a 100-book reading list. Once you get through my 100-book reading list, then you can read about everything I've ever written and thought in my entire life. But start with that reading list. I think it's very, very important. And again, what I focus on, John, is, hey, we understand that mankind's made of crooked timber, but we should have an obligation to try to leave the world a little bit better than it came in. We can't change everything overnight. And that's why I have my own 10 commandments. They're different than the other 10 commandments. Because I think the other commandments are focused on not doing things. Not cheating on your wife, not lying. Mine have affirmative obligation. Be kind. Be wise. Be benevolent. See if you can diminish injustice. Which I think is a higher calling than just, hey, I didn't hurt anybody else. That's good, but the reason why we have brains and morals to do good, not just to be neutral on that score.
That's right. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us. Always great to see you.
Thank you, John. It's a wonderful program.
Thank you.